Nuclear disasters. April 26 marks the 40th year since the start of the 1986 Chernobyl nuclear disaster in Ukraine. In an attempt to keep the radiation releases from the site under control, more than 40 nations came together what is called the New Safe Confinement Structure to confine the radioactive remains of that disaster. It was intended to last as a protective shield for at least 100 years. But then, as one nuclear expert tells us,
the problem with nuclear power is that no one counts on war. And the Russians hit the containment, this structure, this $3 billion containment. They poked a hole in it, but in addition, that caused a fire in the insulation. It was severely damaged. It was 7 or 8 days before they were able to completely isolate the fire. The containment, if you look at it from the right angles, you won't see the hole, but a containment with a hole in it is not really a containment anymore.
So what does that mean, and where do we go from here? Well, when nuclear engineer and whistleblower Arne Gundersen goes over the current information about Chernobyl and the damaged new safe confinement structure, you get to see the everlasting nature of a nuclear disaster despite our best efforts to keep it under control. And this reveals yet another perspective on that awful, deadly, dangerous seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we look back at the Chernobyl nuclear disaster on the brink of its 40th anniversary. We provide a summary of what happened there and its lingering effects. Hear from a woman who was 15 years old and living in Bulgaria when the disaster happened, leading to her exposure to radioactive fallout during Russia's May Day celebrations. And nuclear engineer Arne Gundersen provides insight into the current status of Chernobyl in the wake of the Russian drone strike that knocked a hole in the new safe confinement structure that was supposed to keep us safe from the ongoing nuclear radiation releases. We will also have nuclear news from around the world. Jack Cohen Joppa of the Nuclear Resistor with another story from our shared history of activist resistance to nuclear reactors and weapons, and lots more honest and verified nuclear information. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, April 14, 2026, and here is this week's 40th anniversary special on the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. First, some history. This is sourced from a New York Times article of March 25, 2025, by Kim Barker. She wrote, "Chernobyl was left as a deadly radioactive husk of a destroyed reactor site. To limit its deadly radiation releases, within 24 days of the explosion, Russia started building an enclosure, which they called a sarcophagus, an emergency building encasing the most dangerous area around Unit 4. The sarcophagus locked in 200 tons of radioactive lava-like corium, 30 tons of highly contaminated dust, and 16 tons of uranium and plutonium. This was at best a temporary measure, and by 1996, the structure had deteriorated to the point where numerous stabilization measures were required. The new safe containment structure was designed with the primary goal of confining the radioactive remains of Reactor 4 for 100 years. It also aimed to allow for a partial demolition of the original sarcophagus from inside the structure, a process expected to take years, if not decades. It was constructed 590 feet, or 180 meters, west of Reactor 4, and slid into place on the equivalent of railroad tracks. The new safe confinement is so large it's visible from space, and as of its implementation in 2016, is the world's largest movable land-based structure. Sliding the structure along foundation rails was a difficult process, taking more than 2 weeks, and plans have continued for removing the radioactive remains inside starting later this year. But on February 14, a drone with a high explosive warhead punched a hole in the steel shell. While the initial fire was quickly put out, a waterproof membrane inside the insulation of the arch burned and smoldered for almost 3 weeks. Emergency workers had to work in mountain climbing equipment to knock more holes into the shield's outer layer, hunting for the fire, and spraying water inside a structure designed to stay dry to prevent corrosion. On March 7, Ukraine declared the fire officially extinguished, and radiation levels outside Chernobyl are still normal, according to the International Atomic Energy Agency and Ukrainian nuclear regulators. But repairs could take years. Sean Burney, a nuclear specialist at Greenpeace who visited the damaged reactor at Chernobyl after the drone attack, said, "The reason the international community spent so much money and time building this structure is because they know the scale of the threat radiologically inside. It's an enormous intellectual achievement to build something that could protect Europe, Ukraine, and the world from what's inside. And now the Russians have basically blown a hole in it, both physically and metaphorically." The IAEA said the shell's confinement function had been compromised and that the structure needed extensive repair efforts. Several experts have said the entire shell might have to be removed, dismantled, and replaced, with the head of the Chernobyl Operations Department saying, "Full restoration of the facility is practically impossible. To bring it as close to possible to its original state, well, that would require hundreds of millions of dollars." There is one additional set of factors that did not show up in the New York Times article, something that I was made aware of several years ago, right before the new safe confinement structure was rolled into place. In a private conversation I had with someone who worked with the engineers at the Chernobyl site, she related something they'd been talking about privately, that there were potential problems with the structure they had not taken into account, including with global warming. The permafrost underlying the structure has been melting and softening. The structure weighs more than 31,000 tons. And even back in 2016, there were concerns that the weight on the softened ground could potentially lead to subsidence, putting stress on the structure, leading to potential cracks, misalignment of parts, and structural vulnerabilities. Also with subsidence, the rails along which the building traveled could be warped, making it difficult, if not impossible, to reverse the passage of the building if necessary. At the time, they were debating whether the building could be successfully moved into place. So with the uncertain future of the heavily damaged new safe confinement building, the legacy of Chernobyl continues to threaten the world as an ongoing nuclear radiation disaster with no end. So what was it like on the ground in nearby countries as the disaster first began playing out? To find out one perspective, I spoke with Bonnie Kunova. She was a 15-year-old living in communist Bulgaria when the Chernobyl disaster began. But no one knew about it because the Soviet Union said nothing to its people. On May 1st, May Day, only 5 days after the disaster began, Bulgarian citizens were encouraged, interesting semantics for the Russian mandate, encouraged by the Soviet hierarchy to attend all-day celebrations of the communist state outdoors, in the rain, at the exact time that the worst of Chernobyl's radiation plume was directly overhead, the radioactive fallout brought down to Earth in every raindrop. Kunova now lives in the United States. Here, she paints the picture of the impact of that radioactive rainout and lets us know the results of this devastating experience on her life. To create a more personal picture of Chernobyl's lasting effects on people and the environment, I spoke with Bonnie Kunova. She was a 16-year-old living in Sofia, Bulgaria, about 800 miles away from Chernobyl, when the accident began in 1986. She currently lives in the United States with her husband and three children. When Chernobyl happened on April 26th of 1986, where were you living?
I was living in Sofia, the capital of Bulgaria. Bulgaria is a small country in the Balkan Peninsula. And typically on the maps of the Chernobyl fallout, it's colored in gray, like it wasn't affected. Unfortunately, the reason for that is because the government never allowed any tests and never any data has been released about the impact. But the impact definitely has been devastating.
You were living in Bulgaria. What, if anything, did you learn about Chernobyl when it happened?
When it happened, nobody of the ordinary people knew anything about it. It was kept as a deep secret, as the communist government at that time felt obligated to be loyal to the Soviet Union powers that be. And, of course, Soviet Union couldn't do anything wrong or make any mistake. Therefore, there was nothing going on. And not only we weren't told, but when there was some whispers in the air, the government, Bulgarian government, officially went on national TV and declared that there's no problem and we can eat spinach and lettuce and drink milk and be outside. And we actually mandatory, I was a teenage girl at that time, were forced to march in some communist rally on exactly the same day when there was a rain that was dragging down the nuclear hot particles, and basically the nuclear rain was raining upon us.
How soon after it happened did you start hearing the whispers that something was wrong?
Basically, besides occasional whisper, nothing really was declared until the fall of the communism in 1989.
So it was
three years and a half, yeah.
During that time, were people aware of any changes, either in the food or in health or in children?
People observed numerous changes. The plants that spring all looked burned and yellow and gray and brown. Some of the annual vegetables, especially the most sensitive, like spinach and lettuce I mentioned, were also brown and dead, some of them just looking strange. Some of the lettuces actually grew huge, like 3-4 size times bigger than the usual size. The next few summers, I actually was working in a farming community, and I heard from local farmers that they have observed strange changes in their baby animals. Every spring, all of them have their baby goats and sheep and cows and horses. And then they had amazingly high number of animals, either stillborn, born with organs and limbs that are like multiple numbers, like five legs or two heads or just like missing parts. I actually remember particularly in 1988, I worked a little bit longer. So it happened that my birthday in September was... I was still working there, and the farmers were so sweet. They wanted to throw a party for me, and they actually killed a baby goat. And that goat had sex organs for female and male. And if that was a novel, that would be foreshadowing of the future problems, because I heard from a scientist that the different creatures have different time of responding to radiation, and more primitive or simple organisms mutate faster, obviously. At that time, I heard from a scientist that they expect the peak in the mutations in humans to occur 10 years after Chernobyl, which was exactly when my son was born. But apparently, that even wasn't the most dramatic peak, because according to the recent statistics, the problems and the mutations continue even in a worse way year after year. So we really don't know when the peak will be.
How were babies affected by this?
The babies that were born at that time had bone problems, skin problems, respiratory problems.
You were talking before we did the interview. You mentioned about a child that you knew who was born 3 days after Chernobyl happened.
Yeah, that was my doctor. My son's doctor daughter was born 3 days after Chernobyl. And even that doctor, who was a medical personnel and very intelligent woman, wasn't aware of what's going on. So she was exposing her daughter to the sun, which is traditional for the area. And then
this is part of the health for giving the baby vitamin D.
Especially that winter time in Bulgaria is dark and cold, so you do need that exposure. Yes, her daughter's bones were literally melted, and she needed support for the rest of her life.
Her bones were melted.
Yeah, they were so soft that they couldn't support her body ever.
And she survived?
She survived with normal, otherwise intelligent girl, but disabled for life.
Did the government continue to deny that there was anything wrong?
Absolutely. The government continued to deny. There was no comment at all. The food wasn't withheld, so people actually were encouraged to eat food that was definitely contaminated. While later on in the investigation, it turned out that the government itself had deliveries with charter airplanes from New Zealand, special food for them and their families, and their families were in underground shelters. But the ordinary people were actually sent to march on the streets for rallies and get all the exposure that was at that time the strongest at its peak. So, no, there was no officially released any information besides the talk among people and lots of jokes. Bulgarians like to joke on political topics.
Tell me some Chernobyl jokes.
Grandson is asking his grandfather, "Hey, grandpa, tell me what was it in Chernobyl at that time?" And the grandfather answers, "Oh, nothing much. Don't worry about it." And pat his grandson on both of his heads. Yeah, I know it's bad. We shouldn't laugh, but it's... So, yeah, the grandson got two heads. And unfortunately, that's the reality for that area. If you look at any documentary, you can see children with tumors as big as their heads or organs outside of their bodies. And unfortunately, it doesn't get better. If you look at the data for Russia and Ukraine and all these areas that were affected, still it doesn't get better. Still people have all of these problems.
Talk to me about what happened with your son.
When I turned 24, I got pregnant. My husband at that time was also a mountaineer and outdoor man, and he was exposed to the Chernobyl radiation even in a closer proximity to the explosion. And I was marching in that communist rally that was mandatory, unfortunately. You couldn't sneak out unless you wanted to get in a serious trouble. I was young and healthy. I have no history of genetic diseases in our family. Same with my ex-husband. But our son was born and immediately diagnosed with Down syndrome. And the day he was born, there were 42 or 3 kids in the hospital. 3 out of them were Down syndrome kids, which is extremely high ratio of Down syndrome for the normal population.
Right, the normal percentage is what?
Those are all young mothers. For that age group, the normal ratio, I believe, is 1 in 3,000, something like that. And Bulgaria used to be a clean country and actually was pretty low genetic diseases. At that time, with my son, there were 3 more babies in the hospital with Down syndrome. That was a huge tragedy for all these people because on the top of it, the country wasn't prepared. There was no such frequency of problems, mental problems or genetic problems. So there was no system of support, no services available for them. And these kids were really, really victims.
So what is it that has shown up in your son?
Well, he's severely mentally retarded. He has heart defect and other problems that are related to the genetic disease, like weak muscles, weak joints, blood problems, stomach problems. Also, I'm diagnosed with thyroid problems, immune problems, once in a while, tumors here and there, which are pretty benign. But all of this actually, according to doctors, is linked to the exposure to radiation because there's no history of any of it in our family. And I'm a pretty healthy person. I also was a mountaineer. So all of these problems, actually, according to the medical authorities, are linked to Chernobyl. And actually, my son officially is labeled as environmental case by the governmental workers who actually try to get support for these kids. Even before I got a son with Down syndrome, I was very dedicated to the environmental movement. And I was very aware that we are not capable of controlling and using safely the nuclear power. So I was actually a fighter against it. We actually did protests every springtime, every 26th of April. We were giving black ribbons to the pedestrians in Sofia, and we were doing protests. And there was actually pretty fun rallies in which everybody was dressed as a mutant. So we were having fun with that. But given a chance to tell people one thing, I want to say this. I don't want to leave a message about story about some strange girl with a Slavic accent who had an unpleasant experience with the bad communist government, got screwed, her son got screwed, and then she somehow managed to come to America and get a little bit better help for her and her son. That's all great, but that's not really what I want to say. The communist governments were evil and they were capable of lying, but they are not the only government capable of lying. I'm afraid that in any situation, powers that be serve their buddies, the people with power and money. And if big money is involved in developing nuclear power in any country, the governments will cover for them, and they did cover, as we saw in the case of Fukushima. The information wasn't released. We still don't know what kind of impact that horrible event will have. I feel for the Japanese people, and I know that it has had impact on America too. So since Chernobyl in my country and in the whole area, the percentage of genetic diseases, stillborn babies, miscarriages, cancer, tumors, respiratory problems, thyroid problems, bone and blood problems are skyrocketing. It's epidemic. I talked to the director of the biggest, most specialized hospital in Bulgaria, who happened to be somebody I know. She said that miscarriages and genetic illnesses in Bulgaria are almost like considered like a flu, like something that almost everybody experiences. And this is not normal, and it's not okay, and it's not easy. I myself actually lost a baby a few years ago. And this is a huge tragedy that some people maybe never recover from. And we shouldn't take it lightly. We shouldn't say, oh, that's the price for using nuclear energy. There are other alternative sources of energy. We really don't need to play with that extremely dangerous energy that we really don't know how to control and how to store the waste. And it's just really something that we should leave alone.
What are your thoughts about what's facing Japan as a result of Fukushima?
I'm seriously concerned about what will happen in 5 or 10 years with the kids who will be born at that time after Fukushima, but kids from parents who have been in the area, or the little ones who already have been exposed. Are they going to develop all kinds of cancers, tumors, headaches, bleeding? We really don't know. And I feel for them and I worry about them. And I don't think that that's how we should treat our future, our kids. If even if we are ready to play Russian roulette or Japanese roulette, we should give the chance to our kids to actually have a safe environment and enjoy their lives without having to deal with tumors and cancers and fear and pain and disabilities. Because even one kid growing with tumor or, like in case of my son, intellectual disability and heart defects has huge impact. Their life is so much tougher and so much opportunities are taken away. It's like a curse upon them. They're really robbed. This is a robbery officially imposed to them. And even one kid is too much if we're talking about impact of such a negative event. What about million kids? What about million people? I've been told that most of the people who participated in the original cleanup are already gone.
Cleanup of Chernobyl.
Cleanup of Chernobyl. What about the cleanup in Fukushima? I know that they basically sent people who were sent on a suicidal mission, people who knew that basically that's the end of them, and maybe they were really willing to sacrifice themselves. But why do we need to pay that price? We have alternatives. We have alternative sources of energy. We can learn to use less energy. We can learn to be less of a consumerist. There's options. We don't have to be slaves to the nuclear power and sell ourselves so cheap to such a dangerous business.
That was Chernobyl survivor Bonnie Kunova.
We'll return to this week's special feature on the 40th anniversary of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster in just a moment. But first, Chernobyl was a nuclear reactor accident. No blinding flash, no fireball, no mushroom cloud. But in terms of its destructiveness, it was its own kind of nuclear bomb. Uncontrolled radiation releases from the exploded reactor were carried in a cloud of fallout as far away as northern Scandinavia, Belarus, Germany, and much of Western Europe. But even after 40 years, its radioactivity is still, well, active, still wafting around the world, and will be for hundreds, if not thousands, of years, continuing to compromise health, safety, and the DNA of all living things. Yet the nuclear industry insists that reactors are safe. Oh, that was Russian technology. Ignore Fukushima and Three Mile Island and all the leaks and cracks and smaller accidents that put us all at foreseeable risk. Just keep giving them money, money, money. Now for small modular nuclear reactors. Sounds cute, doesn't it? Never mind that none has ever been built, no designs have been approved, and small refers to the amount of electricity they generate in proportion to the amount of fuel that they use and the waste they create. It's a nuclear Ponzi scheme. And we the people are the ones being tricked into not only accepting and supporting it, but embracing it. And that is why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. We don't buy into the nuclear industry's well-financed PR propaganda bovine feces machine. Our stories are vetted, verified, sourced from reputable world-class experts and frontline activists. But we can't keep this show going without your help. I'm talking about donations. So if you're grateful for the information you get here, show me. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, and follow the prompts. If you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that anything you donate is tax deductible. So don't wait. Go now to nuclearhotseat.com and donate. Make a difference. And know that I am deeply grateful that you are listening and that you care. Now back to this week's special feature, part 2 of the anniversary of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. Arne Gundersen is a nuclear engineer, whistleblower, and green energy advocate who has been a consulting expert on many nuclear reactor issues. He's also a regular guest and commentator on Nuclear Hot Seat, prized for his expertise and clarity. Here, he updates the conversation about the problems created by the Soviet drone strike that punched a hole in Chernobyl's new safe confinement structure, the problems of repairing it, and then goes into a comparison between Chernobyl and Fukushima as to which one is the worst nuclear disaster in history and why. Not a race that anybody ever wants to win. My apologies for occasionally calling it the new safe containment instead of new safe confinement structure. I spoke with Arne Gundersen on April 3rd, 2026. Arne Gundersen, great to have you back with us here on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Hi, hey, it's great to be back.
We're coming up on the 40th anniversary of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster, and it seems that the site is at a crossroads yet again. First, briefly, what happened initially at Chernobyl, and what was the radiation danger that it caused?
The Chernobyl reactor is entirely different than the reactors in the rest of the world. The Russian design was different. The movie, the Netflix series on Chernobyl is a phenomenal piece of work that explains pretty much everything that happened. If you got 7 or 8 hours for the 5 episodes, that movie is phenomenal. But what happened was that the government did not tell the operators how unstable the reactor really was. And so the operators did move control rods in a way they thought was legal. And it caused not just a meltdown, but essentially a bomb. What happens when a nuclear atom splits, it gives off a lot of energy. But in a bomb, the splitting occurs, the compounding rate is on the order of like a millionth of a second. In a nuclear reactor, the compounding rate is in about a hundredth of a second. So you can control a nuclear reactor, but you can't control the bomb. So the Chernobyl reactor became a bomb, and the power level increased 10 times higher than what the reactor was ever designed for. They blew the lid off the reactor, and the Soviet reactors did not have a Western-style containment. But it wouldn't have mattered anyway. There was so much energy that the containment would have shattered anyway. So this radiation instantaneously started to pour out of the reactor and was wafted by winds, first over Belarus and Ukraine, and then it headed up towards Scandinavia, Wales, Germany, even Italy. They're finding the residual in Italian olives and in wild boar in Germany, even now, 40 years after. The Laplanders up in very northern Finland have contaminated the lichen that the reindeer chew on. They're still contaminated, and they have to bring in reindeer meat to maintain the indigenous community. So it was the worst instantaneous, I'll say, eruption, explosion in nuclear history. Let's keep in mind instantaneous, because I think when we look at Fukushima may in fact be worse in the long term, but the reaction at Chernobyl was hideous. If your readers go up online and look for something called the elephant's foot, the nuclear core melted down, and there's this molten mass of a combination of nuclear fuel and metal that's in the basement. And it sort of looks like an elephant's foot, highly, highly radioactive. But that's where the nuclear core is right now, sitting as a solid lump of incredibly highly radioactive stuff, even 40 years after.
In the immediate aftermath of the disaster, what was done to confine Chernobyl's radiation?
There was a lot of really, really quick, courageous work done to get the radiation back into the building that it was blown out of. And in the process, there was about 600,000 Russians called the liquidators who were highly exposed to radiation and are still being paid for by the state because of the exposure. So the first thing they did was very rapidly clean up the site. And again, that Chernobyl movie's phenomenal in that regard. But then the question was, well, what do you do now? You've got a building with no roof that's still highly radioactive. So they built something called a sarcophagus. And when you do construction of something that's massive, it's important to get a good foundation. And they didn't have time. So basically, they built a building as quickly as they possibly could. I'm not placing blame here. They were on the clock. They had to get this thing covered up. And it began to crack over time. And it was obvious that it wasn't going to last a long time. So the first sarcophagus was a quick and dirty fix, appropriate given the speed at which it had to be done. But because they couldn't make the foundation solid, it was sort of doomed to crack. But it did its job. Then Ukraine is a poor country, and at the time, the Soviet Union was collapsing. So whatever finances were available were incredibly limited. And what happened then is the EU, the European Union, came in and helped. And they built a second, I'll call it a containment structure, a second sarcophagus. This is a beautiful piece of engineering. It looks like the old dirigible hangars. It's a semicircle, and it's long. It was not built over the reactor because it's so radioactive, but it was designed to be rolled over the reactor after it was built. So if you can imagine half a cylinder rolled over the reactor. Now, to give you an idea how high this thing is, the Statue of Liberty would fit under it. This is a massive piece of engineering, and it was designed to last 100 years, at which point the theory is that the radiation levels would be low enough that they might begin to be able to dismantle the reactor.
I want to make the point that the new safe confinement took 9 years to build,
cost some 2.7 billion with a B US dollars, and the funding was contributed to by more than 40 nations.
Yes, it was a, I don't know if it was a global effort, but certainly the entire European community, and I imagine the US and perhaps the Russia. Yeah, $3 billion is a lot of money for this structure. And it's impressive, and it was designed to last 100 years.
That was great in theory, but what happened to the new safe confinement on February 14, 2025?
As the result of a drone strike.
The problem with nuclear power is that no one counts on war. And the Russians hit the containment, this structure, this $3 billion containment. They poked a hole in it, but in addition, that caused a fire in the insulation. It was severely damaged. It was 7 or 8 days before they were able to completely isolate the fire. The containment, if you look at it from the right angles, you won't see the hole, but a containment with a hole in it is not really a containment anymore. So the question is now, how do you repair this thing? Do you pull it back and repair it away from the reactor, in which case now you've got this open to the elements nuclear reactor again? I think they're still trying to figure out what the best way of doing it. And of course, there's still a war. So the issue here is the same as that the Zaporizhia nuke in Ukraine as well, is that nuclear plants are not designed to be bombed. Maybe they can withstand a hurricane or a flood, but they're not designed for missiles or drones and things like that. And really, the Chernobyl containment won't be safe until that war is over. And who knows when that will be.
Has there been an acknowledged or a measured radiation release from Chernobyl since this damage took place last year?
The bulk of the airborne radiation from Chernobyl was released in the first month. The vast majority that contaminated Europe and Belarus and Ukraine. So the vast majority was released in the first couple of weeks to month. But it is still releasing gases now. So maybe 1/1000th of what it used to, but there's a lot of radiation still coming off that, which this was designed to prevent. And it was also designed to prevent the elements from causing further damage. Rain in the nuclear reactor will cause the radiation to enter the groundwater. So the radiation is going down and up. So the containment, this new containment structure, which now has a hole in it, is no longer containing. I think it's better that it's there than to be completely removed, but it still has a hole in it. And a containment with a hole in it really isn't a containment.
It's been announced that it could take another 3 to 4 years before the outer dome's primary safety functions can be regained. And the cost is estimated at 500 million euros, or approximately 576 million US dollars. What are the risks until this hole is repaired?
Well, it will continue to leak gaseous radiation. There's no doubt about it. So for the next 3 or 4 years, radioactive gases will continue to come out, and small particles, they're called hot particles, that will be wafted out and transported to the environment. There's no doubt that you'll have fallout with that containment dome missing. Nobody knows how to fix this yet. Part of the problem here is that the structure was the first of its kind. And so now you're damaging a structure that was the first of its kind. It's a tough engineering feat. And hey, a $500 million is a lot of money.
You have said that as bad as the original Chernobyl accident was and continues to be, Fukushima is the worst disaster. Why do you say that?
I was friends with Alexei Yablokov, who was the science advisor to Yeltsin during the Soviet Union. And Alexei and I agreed on this, that the initial blast from Chernobyl was worse than the initial blast from Fukushima. But Chernobyl is one reactor core, and Fukushima is three. So there's essentially three times more radiation in the nuclear, in three different nuclear containments than there is in the one at Chernobyl. That's point one, is that you have three cores at Fukushima and one at Chernobyl. The other thing is that, let's get back to that elephant's foot. The elephant's foot is dry. It's sunk into the basement, but it's not in contact with groundwater. So that the majority of the water, of the radioactivity that was in the nuclear core is very highly radioactive, but it's dry. So it's not entering the groundwater. So that's not true at Fukushima. At Fukushima, the containments did fail. All three exploded, but after a day, as opposed to initially, the initial radioactivity from Fukushima was less. Although they did pick up noble gases, xenon and krypton, in Seattle at 400,000 times higher radiation levels than normal.
And these would be radiation releases from Fukushima?
Yes. Within a week or so after the meltdowns at Fukushima, the radiation spiked in Seattle, which is an indication that the containments failed. So the Fukushima containments failed, just like the Chernobyl containment, but they failed a little bit later, and that means that less radioactivity was released initially. So the point one is both containments failed, but Chernobyl is worse initially. Point two is that when Chernobyl melted down, it melted into the basement, but it's dry. That's not true at Fukushima. All three nuclear reactor cores melted down. Think of the nuclear reactor as a giant pressure cooker. The nuclear core reached 2,200 degrees. It ignited the water. So the water created hydrogen and oxygen and exploded and failed the containments. Then that molten mass laid at the bottom of the pressure cooker, and then the pressure cookers melted through. And we know that because they have been able to get remote probes underneath the Fukushima reactors, and they found pieces that definitely belonged in the core that are 4 and 5 inches big. So there's holes in the bottom of these nuclear reactors that are at least 4 or 5 inches, and nobody really knows for sure. So the Chernobyl elephant's foot, you can actually, you know, stick your head in the room if you're quick and see it. The Fukushima reactors, you can't. So there's 880 tons of uranium at Fukushima, the three cores, and they've only removed about 2 or 3 ounces of it for analysis. So, you know, we were talking about billions of dollars at Chernobyl. The bill at Fukushima is now estimated at $750 billion. And perhaps when you figure the communities around, it actually is a $1 trillion problem. Now, I've been an advocate of doing exactly what they did at Chernobyl, is put a containment over it and prevent the groundwater from getting in. The key difference between Fukushima is that now the core is sitting in groundwater, because the nuclear containment building is not a solid thing. It's got pipes going in and out with rubber gaskets to keep the pipes from sliding. And nobody anticipated the temperatures, pressures, and radiation levels, and all that rubber has disintegrated. So now water's coming in, water's going out, and the groundwater under the site is becoming contaminated, which is why they're continually pumping water out into those tanks. It's not so much to cool the core as it is because the groundwater is becoming increasingly contaminated. I was approached by people in the oil industry. And you'll recall the Deepwater Horizon that blew up in the Gulf. They injected drilling mud into that hole and plugged it. Drilling mud is a hydraulic fluid that eliminates the groundwater from seeping through. So I actually, years ago, I approached friends in Japan about the concept of using drilling mud to seal the site. And the Japanese have a not invented here syndrome, and they decided to go with an ice wall instead, which has been ineffective. But if they were to seal the plant, completely seal it, put drilling mud around the entire facility, they could prevent the inflow of groundwater and then put a containment over it and walk away for 100 years. My theory is that right now they're jeopardizing the gene pool of Japan. They're going to have thousands of young men, constructive people, on that site working to clean it up and becoming irradiated. And there's got to be genetic damage. My theory was keep the water out of the basement, button it up, and come back in 100 years, at which point the radiation levels will be 20 or 30 times lower. Not zero, and the plutonium stays forever, but most of the radiation that the workers would be exposed to would be much, much less. I thought it was more humane for the workers, and I also thought it was genetically humane for the entire country. Somebody sent me the clothing from a worker, and I don't know how it ever got through customs because it was radioactive, but we got the complete garb from a worker when I lived in Vermont, and we tested it. And you want to guess where the most contaminated spot on the clothing was?
I would have to say somewhere in the genital area.
The zipper. Yep. Yep. So the genetic damage to thousands of men in a country, I just don't think it's fair. So button it up for 100 years. But we're dealing with a $1 trillion problem at Fukushima. And just the containment at Chernobyl is $3 or $4 billion. And they haven't even begun to discuss how to dismantle the facility. And they're going to kick that can down the road 100 years. Both of these facilities are $1 billion problems, which you can build an awful lot of wind turbines for $2 trillion.
And one last thing about the radioactive water from Fukushima. It's been siphoned off and put into tanks, but TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power Company, and the government have said that they don't have any more space. So they have been doing batch releases of this radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean. What does that portend for the future?
I hate to say it, but it's not just that water. The ground is contaminated and is leaking into the Pacific as well. Now, everybody looks at the tanks, which they claim to be demineralizing before they release. But in fact, the stuff that's sitting in the groundwater is percolating right down into the Pacific and is not treated. And this is where I really consider the Fukushima disaster to be worse than Chernobyl. The releases into bodies of water, the groundwater and the Pacific, are hundreds of times worse than the releases into the groundwater at Chernobyl. So they're dramatically different. One had a very quick release of an awful lot of radiation, and one had significant releases for months at a clip, and now we have contaminated groundwater and contaminated Pacific. So they are comparable. When people say Chernobyl was the worst, it was for the first week, but I'm not convinced when you look at the span of time over a decade or more that Fukushima doesn't become on the same par as Chernobyl.
Anything you'd like to add?
You know, they are continually finding radioactive fish in the Pacific, relatively near the plant, a couple miles away. Then, of course, right after the meltdowns, they found tuna that had swum from Japan all the way over to San Diego and were too radioactive to eat. So the Pacific's a big place. And if you compare it to like the Great Lakes, where the Palisades nuclear reactor is, the Pacific is 10,000 times bigger than all of the Great Lakes combined. So if we have a meltdown at a Palisades or at a plant, there's 40 plants that surround the Great Lakes. The impact on the aquatic ecosystems will be phenomenal. It's time. I always say, you know, that Eisenhower had this thing called the Atoms for Peace program. And the theory was that America would build 1,000 nukes. I've been saying now it's time to pick up the pieces after atoms for peace.
Arne Gundersen, it's always a revelation, a shock, and in certain ways a pleasure to know that we're getting the straight facts from you on all of this in great detail and specificity. And I want to thank you for once again being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you for having me, and thanks for all the work you do. I mean, my work pales in comparison with the effort you put in. Thank you.
Nuclear engineer and whistleblower Arne Gundersen. Now, just in time for tax day, did you know the longest war tax protest in U.S. history began with one couple's conscientious refusal to pay for nuclear weapons or war, a commitment that inspired supporters nationwide and built a community through the power of nonviolent direct action? Here with another story from our shared history of resisting nukes is Jack Cohen-Joppa, co-coordinator of the Nuclear Resister.
It's tax season, and if nothing is certain but death and taxes, what if we don't want our taxes, the fruit of our labors, to hasten the certain death of others? We could just not pay, but that too has a cost. Newly married, Betsy Corner and Randy Kaler understood the cost when they stopped paying for war in 1977, the first year they filed jointly. Each year, Betsy and Randy gave notice to the tax man about their refusal to pay while donating their taxes due to groups helping the poor and victims of war. Their war tax resistance was grounded in their shared opposition to the deadly connection between U.S. militarism abroad and its ever-present threat of nuclear attack. And while profoundly personal in its impact, their ongoing tax resistance was no secret, as Randy gained prominence as the national director of the influential Nuclear Weapons Freeze campaign in the early 1980s. In March 1989, the federal government legally seized their family home in the town of Coleraine, Massachusetts, to recover $32,000 in unpaid federal taxes. Western Massachusetts was by then known not only for anti-nuclear activism, but also a long history of war tax resistance. Assured of their neighbors' support, Betsy, Randy, and their young daughter stayed put. In 1990, the IRS tried to auction off the house, but there were no bidders. The government ended up buying the home for the minimum bid of $5,100. Supporters had publicized the politics of the home seizure, and potential buyers had learned that while the government was auctioning title to the house sat on land leased from a community land trust that had no interest in cooperating with the seizure. A year later, the family still hadn't moved out, so the government successfully sued to evict them. They were ordered to leave by Thanksgiving Day. They did not. Randy was alone at home when federal agents came knocking on December 3, 1991. They took him into custody. That afternoon, a federal marshal returned to Coleraine and arrested Betsy Corner at a neighbor's home. The couple were soon brought before a federal judge who only wanted to know if they intended to reoccupy the home or encourage others to do so. Prevented from reading his prepared statement, Kaler responded simply, "It is my intention to oppose the use of my tax dollars for killing and preparations for war." He was found in contempt and taken straight to jail for up to 6 months or until he agreed to comply with the eviction order. Acting on her intention to avoid jail in order to care for their daughter, Betsy Corner agreed not to reoccupy the home. But when she was asked by the court if she planned to organize others to occupy the house, she reminded them that her supporters were acting on their own behalf. And that next morning, 150 supporters rallied outside their home. 14 people dubbed the Morning After Team then removed the locks installed by federal marshals and re-entered the home. They remained overnight, the first of at least a dozen affinity groups who had pledged to take nonviolence training, occupy the home for a week at a time, risk arrest, and provide support to those in jail and their families. The house was successfully auctioned off in February 1992, 2 months after Kaler's arrest, for $5,400. Police arrested seven occupiers that day, and Kaler was ordered released from jail, his contempt mooted by the sale of his property. Despite lacking a valid lease for the land, police soon helped the new owners move into the house while Betsy and Randy's supporters sustained their 24/7 peace vigil in a tent shelter pitched on land trust property right next to their house. Over the next 18 months, the Colerain action turned into the longest and most remarkable war tax protest in U.S. history. Police made 60 arrests, mostly for trespass, including 52 people who spent from 5 days to 2 weeks in jail. The final arrests occurred in September 1993, after a court-ordered injunction forced an end to the vigil. The government never did recover all they claimed was due, and over the span of those several years, Betsy, Randy, and their daughter, and hundreds of their friends and neighbors experienced the power of building community through a commitment to nonviolent direct action. To learn more about the many options for war tax resistance, the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee at nwtrcc.org has a wealth of excellent resources. This has been Jack Cohen-Joppa for Nuclear Hot Seat, with a tax season story from the archives of the Nuclear Resistor.
Jack Cohen-Joppa of the Nuclear Resistor, who can be reached through the website nukeresistor.org. And if you would like to explore information about your taxes and resistance, there's a group called the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee, and it can be reached at nwprcc.org. Or just go to the website. We will have a link up, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 772. And a quick activist shout-out. The International Uranium Film Festival will be held in Chicago on April 24th through 26th at DePaul University. It's being sponsored by the Nuclear Energy Information Service. And we will have a link up for further information on our website, NuclearHotSeat.com, under this episode, number 772. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, April 14, 2026. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, we make it easy. Sign up for it on our website, NuclearHotSeat.com, and you will see a big honking yellow box. Just fill in your first name and whatever email address you want to use and send it to us. And then every week, in return, you will get one email with the link to that week's show as soon as it posts and a short description of its content. Do that, and you never need miss a single update to what's happening in the nuclear world. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send that to me in an email at info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, thank you. Any amount you can provide will help us out, and we really do appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2026, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, a nuclear accident anywhere is a nuclear accident everywhere. This from former chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Allison McFarland. And there you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.